content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Maureen McDonald for the North Carolina Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, we'll be reading to you from the November 2024 Walter Magazine. We begin with Opening Doors of Happiness. Raleigh's Governor Moorhead School has been changing lives for visually impaired children since 1845 by Catherine Snow Smith. 8-year-old Allison Bolivar seems reluctant to release her father's hand. It's time to line up for the opening ceremonies of the annual Braille Challenge at the Governor Moorhead School in Raleigh, which takes place in February, and she's a little nervous. Bolivar is one of 21 children from across the state competing in a day of proofreading, spelling, reading comprehension, and deciphering charts. Bolivar came from Robeson County with her parents just for the event, like 8 other families who traveled across the state. The other 12 competitors live on campus. Since 1845, children have been letting go of a parent's hand to venture into an unknown world at this school for the visually impaired, which was first called the North Carolina Institution of the Deaf, Dumb, and the Blind. The name was changed to honor Governor John Motley Moorhead in 1964. The school currently instructs 45 students and boards 42. The children they serve range in age from 5 to 21 and hail from as far west as Newton and as far east as Edenton. Students never pay to attend the school, which is supported largely by private donations and some state funding. The Ash Avenue campus, 2 miles from Pullen Park, is dotted with red brick buildings centered around a small garden with a bronze bust of Helen Keller, a quote from whom is etched in both Braille and traditional letters. Quote, "When one door of happiness closes, another one opens," end quote. A door of happiness opened wide at the school for one of its most famous alumnus, 6-time Grammy winner Ronnie Millsap. According to Millsap's 1977 biography, Almost Like a Song, when he was born blind in the mountain town of Robbinsville, his mother thought it was a punishment from God and wanted nothing to do with him. His grandparents raised him until he moved, at age 5, to this school where his musical talent budded. Another alumnus, North Carolina musician, musical legend Arthur Lane Doc Watson, credited the school for exposing him to classical and jazz music and for nurturing talent his family already seeded, according to the Bluegrass Music Hall of Fame. Bolivar also has an inclination for music and is learning to play the guitar at church. Her confidence isn't as strong 95 miles away from her hometown of Shannon, population 246. But when MC Susan Patterson announces Bolivar's name, the girl is the first to make her way beneath the tunnel of canes with a shy smile that turns up ever so slightly toward her thick, dark bangs. Akin to a military arch of swords, the ceremonial tunnel is formed by almost 20 GMS teachers and employees from the State Library of North Carolina's Accessible Services Division. "Scholars, best of luck to you," says GMS Principal Matthew Meskel, after all students are introduced. "I hope you enjoy the competition, but more importantly, I hope you enjoy each other's company." 50 competitors with highest scores from around the country will go on to compete in the Braille Challenge Finals in Los Angeles this summer, including one Raleigh teenager, Reese Blum. "You get to make a lot of new friends," Blum says, as she leaves the Braille Challenge and begins climbing a tree on the school's campus. "I made a really good friend there who's not from here. I'm still going to support her, and she's going to support me, even if one of us doesn't make it as a finalist." hopes of making friends eased the pain when Susan Patterson left her Robeson County home at age 10 in 1966 to live at the Raleigh School. Because she was black, she attended Governor Moorhead's School for African Americans on Garner Road, 5 miles south of the Capitol building. North Carolina was the first state in the nation to start a school for visually impaired black children in 1869, after the Civil War, but wouldn't fully integrate it until 1977. Being a child, I really was kind of excited, Patterson says. I thought to myself, more friends. She wasn't completely blind, but Patterson didn't start attending school in Lumberton until she was 8 and was behind her grade level when she arrived in Raleigh. The many large print books at the Governor Moorhead School, smaller classes, and specialized teachers opened a whole new door. I caught up fast. In fact, I skipped some grades, she says. Patterson was among the first black students to integrate the school's main campus on Ash Avenue in 1967. I remember wondering why these people didn't say anything to us or acknowledge us, Patterson recalls, of the white students on campus. But then as I got older, I thought, well, we didn't really do anything to acknowledge them. I guess it took some getting used to sharing your school with people you don't know. After it all settled down, some of us became the best of friends with each other. Patterson is a key organizer for annual Governor Moorhead School reunions, which often include a tour of the old Garner Road School that now houses the State Bureau of Investigation. She went on to earn her associate's degree in early child education at Central Piedmont Community College in Charlotte and worked as a house parent at the Governor Moorhead School for 28 years until she retired 12 years ago. She's seen many changes at the school. One of the best, she thinks, is that it now sends 4 buses across the state every weekend to transport students home and back. For many decades, most children stayed on campus throughout the school year, even during holidays, because their parents couldn't afford a bus ticket home. I can remember getting that bus ticket to Lumberton for $3.30 about once a month so I could go home, she says. I could call my parents too, but some people didn't even have phones at home, so they didn't talk to their family that whole year. It was hard, but the independence students gained and are still gaining at Governor Moorhead School is as important as their academics, Patterson says. I stress to sighted people, when you're talking about blind people, concentrate on our accomplishments, not our limitations, she says. Next, from the music department, get it on vinyl. Poorhouse expands its music ecosystem with a small batch record press by David Menconi. Poorhouse Music Hall co-owners Adam and Lacey Lindstedt will tell you that the only thing that got them through the big pandemic shutdown was their record shop. They opened it upstairs in the venerable downtown Raleigh space in 2019, and selling records online made survival possible during the dark days of 2020 and 2021. In the process, however, they noticed that a surprising amount of the vinyl records they sold had been pressed overseas. Getting stock could take months, even years, and that led to another poorhouse venture. Looking into our other options, says Adam, it felt like a natural seg for us to go into widget making. That was the genesis of Poorhouse Pressing, the Triangle's only full-scale record pressing operation, and one of just a handful statewide. It's a boutique operation, with Adam running the floor as the, quote, party boss, and Lacey as client manager, or, as she describes it, organizational freak, an advocate for the endangered art of the phone conversation. Almost all of their clients are area performers selling their own records themselves at gigs or through independent record stores. "We don't want to be pressing a million copies of Rumors," says Lacey, referencing the Fleetwood Mac bestseller. "We want to be here for the local acts. There are gigantic plants that can put out 50,000 records a day, and that's where Taylor Swift should go." Overhearing the name of everybody's favorite pop star, 5-year-old Desmond Lindstedt's ears prick up, and he asks if they'll be pressing records for her. "No, Desmond," Lacey tells her son with a laugh, "we're not going to make a Taylor Swift record. We're here for the independents." Poorhouse Pressing occupies a former taxidermy warehouse in an industrial park about 5 miles east of their nightclub on Blunt Street. Getting it started took a do-it-yourself crash course in industry infrastructure, years of work and planning, plus hefty business loans. Although vinyl is a vintage format, pressing records is a complicated, detail-oriented process that requires both boiling hot and cold water, as well as precise timing on the pressing machines. The plant's operation began in the spring of 2024 on two presses, one automatic and one semi-automatic. Poorhouse's current capacity is 1,400 records per 8-hour shift, with orders ranging from 100 copies up to several thousand for bigger jobs. A range of extras are available, including gatefold covers and rainbow covers on the vinyl itself. "We recommend at least 300 because your return on investment is so much better," says Adam. "At 100, you're looking at more than $20 a piece. At 300, it costs about one-third that per copy." Among the local acts who've had records pressed at Poorhouse are rock bands Jack the Radio and PKM, and rapper-poet Sherlett Ammons, who enthused that it's awesome to have a quality vinyl pressing plant right here in our own backyard. Fonte Coleman of Little Brother Foreign Exchange even came in to press a few copies of his latest release himself. "I admire how much time they've put into this," says Coleman, whose 2024 EP, Pacific Time 2, sold all 300 copies through pre-orders in less than a day. Pressing vinyl is an artisanal craft, like blacksmithing. If you don't pass it on, the art form is lost. For many years, vinyl records were the industry standard format before yielding to cassettes in the 1980s and compact discs in the 1990s. When major labels shut down their pressing plants, the format nearly died. Online streaming is the focus these days for the Taylor Swifts and Beyoncés of the world, but vinyl has come back as the physical format of choice. CD sales have declined enough for vinyl records to have outsold them in 2022 for the first time since 1987. That leaves Poorhouse in a solid position. The club, store, and processing plant are all part of the same ecosystem, says Adam. You can play a show at Poorhouse, record it, press it, and sell it at our record store. Now we're involved in three different career elements. Still, long-term sustainability will be a challenge. Adam puts Poorhouse's Presley monthly break-even point at almost $100,000, and that's without either Lindstedt taking a salary yet. "We're still running on the fumes of last year's tax refund," Adam says. Nevertheless, it's an exciting business to be in. "We've never made a hiring announcement, and we still have 300 resumes on file," says Adam. "A lot of teachers and doctors are looking to get out of their jobs. It's a cool thing, but it's still a factory, manufacturing plastics, and you have to get it just right. From the art department, Earth is at the center. Christina Lorena Wisner's Art Explores New Frontiers by Liza Roberts. Christina Lorena Wisner's art emerges from her deep connections to the earth. So its systems and rhythms, its elements and mysteries. She studies the planet like a scientist and discovers it like an explorer, venturing to its far ends to record its extremes in person, to live within its phenomena. She turns her insights into art she hopes will inspire awe for our planet's grandeur and empathy for its vulnerability. Her latest fascination is the North Pole, where she spent 2 weeks immersing herself last spring with an extraordinary art and science residency called the Arctic Circle. I can only describe it as the most impactful experience of my life, Wisner says. I've been immersed in water for a long time, and I wanted to immerse myself into this landscape of glaciers in order to better understand it. The expedition's ship, which carried 30 fellow resident artists and scientists, took Wisner and others to the Svalbard archipelago by outboard zodiacs twice a day, always surrounded by a triangulation of guards with guns to protect them against polar bears. While ashore, Wisner planted an orange safety flag in the ice cape, making it a recurring motif in her photos. She also used a drone to shoot video from above and collected plastic. You're in a land that you know is changing. You're looking at a glacier that might not be here in 100 years. You're looking at history, she says. That history was evident in other ways, too, like a massive pile of whale bones left behind by 19th century whalers and the detritus left behind by scientific explorers of that time. There were many instances where I was thinking of human history as it relates to geological time, Wisner says. The trip was the catalyst for a whole new body of work, says Wisner, who's headed back next May. That work includes still photography of that mythic frontier, sweeping video, and installations that incorporate pieces of plastic she collected in and around Svalbard. Recently, her work was in Surface and Undercurrents, a group show at Dare Arts in Manteo, and this month she's part of a group exhibit at Emerge Gallery and Art Center in Centerville. Next April, she'll be featured in a group show at Central Connecticut State University on climate change in the Arctic, and in June, her work will be exhibited in a solo show at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Arlington, Virginia. A native of Richmond, Virginia, Wisner says she can trace the beginnings of her work as an artist to a job she had with Nag's Head Ocean Rescue in her early 20s. When she wasn't saving swimmers, she stared out at the ocean for 10 hours a day. I would watch the sun move across the sky and the moon come up, she says. I was very aware of these bigger processes, these large-scale movements, like waves coming over from the coast of Africa that we're not even aware of. Other little-seen influences in her work come from her wide-ranging education, which includes a Master of Fine Arts from University of Texas at Austin and separate undergraduate degrees in both World Studies and Fine Arts from Virginia Commonwealth University. The interplay between humans, time, and the planet has long been a theme in her work. As a former competitive swimmer and regular runner and biker, she experiences the world in a visceral way, creating art that is informed by the way we live within the world and the way the world lives with us. From her home in Kitty Hawk, Wisner rides a bike or runs along the beach every day to note its transformations. It's the same beach, but it's completely different. The watercolor, the form of the waves, the temperature of the wind, she says. Sometimes she finds objects to incorporate into sculpture as she goes. Waves and wavelengths, audio, seismic, and light, all inspire her. A meteorite impact crater in southern Germany was the subject of sculpture and installation art she created with the Fulbright grant she was awarded in 2013. She used seismometers to record earthquakes as part of a Mint Museum installation in 2018. One early morning in March 2022, I had the chance to witness her in action. On the shores of Kitty Hawk Sound, I watched as she zipped up her wetsuit, assembled a series of floating sculptures, and waded with them into the frigid waters. The sun wasn't fully up. The air was barely 40 degrees, and the art she was wrangling was bigger than she was. Wisner took it all in stride. In a matter of minutes, she'd glided 50 yards from shore, and her art was floating all around her. The largest of the three pieces of art with her that morning was one she'd attached to her outrigger kayak and towed 275 miles down parts of the Eno and Neuse Rivers and through the Ocracoke Inlet in 2019, recording audiovisual information and environmental data, including a panther sighting, along the way. Two smaller works included discarded beach chairs from one of her regular oceanside jogs. Her approach with every subject, Wisner says, is to embrace what she doesn't know and to let her new knowledge as well as her material guide her. "I'm still a process-oriented artist," she says. "It's about openness to material and play, not taking my work too seriously, and not being too pigeonholed." She thrives when she can employ all of her senses in the making of her art, especially work that involves nature, and she loves making connections across time and place. When the polar vortex winds of 2022 washed an old canoe up on the side of the road near her house, for instance, she picked it up and brought it home. "It had beautiful layering on it," she says. "The water had rotted holes into it. I think it had been submerged in the Sound for a couple of years." The fact that winds from the Arctic dislodged it and brought it to her North Carolina shore fascinated her, she says. And that canoe has become part of her latest Arctic-inspired installations. "No place is an isolated place," says Wisner. "Everything we do, everything that happens in one geographic location impacts other geographic locations." Finally, from the end note, Connected Carolina, Folks in the Triangle Step Up After Helene by Anna Maria Switzer. From Harker's Island to Silva, my world includes some from every part of the state. I'm a student at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and each semester I learn about a new small town where a fellow student grew up. That's what brings the destruction of Hurricane Helene so close to home. It's not just seeing devastating images of places that I love, the camp where I spent summers searching for crawfish, the trails that I explored with my little brother, but the impact on my family, friends, classmates, and professors. That sense of connection to the mountains is deeply felt here in Raleigh. There's been an outpouring of support for Western North Carolina. Folks in the Triangle are extremely generous, says Amy Dominello Braun, Chief Communications Officer for the Raleigh-based North Carolina Community Foundation. The NCCF will use its disaster relief fund to support a long-term recovery process that will span, quote, not just months, but years, she says. The generosity of North Carolinians has impressed folks outside of the state, too. This was by far our largest project, double our second largest, says Alex Clark, the executive director of Operation Airdrop, a Texas-based organization that uses volunteer pilots to provide rapid relief to communities impacted by natural disasters. By gathering donations at local businesses like Raleigh Brewing Company and Andia's Ice Cream, and mobilizing Triangle volunteers to transport them, Operation Airdrop delivered more than 1.2 million pounds of supplies to remote areas in the 10 days following Hurricane Helene. There's no way we could have done it without the help of North Carolinians, he says. Jess Reiser, CEO and co-founder of Asheville-based Burial Beer Company, says the support from the Triangle has been overwhelming in an incredible and heartwarming way. Through support of their Raleigh taproom and online beer sales, Reiser hopes to maintain a heartbeat that will sustain their 130 employees and other small businesses in the area. These have been the hardest weeks of my life, but we're committed to supporting the passion, creativity, and talent of the people that make Asheville, Asheville, Reiser says. Rebuilding Western North Carolina will be an ongoing effort, but if any state can do it, it's North Carolina. Even after national attention moves elsewhere, we will be here, says Braun. Here in the Piedmont, we'll be shoulder to shoulder with our neighbors, helping them rebuild. We've run out of time for today's episode of Walter Magazine. Be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Maureen McDonald for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Walter Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.